whenever you show up to law school and you say, hey, I don't like the government, everyone's kind of just looking at you. Who's, yeah. You know you're in law school, right?
Yeah. I'm here for a reason. Kinsella said, it's like, do you want your oncologist to like cancer? He spent his entire life studying cancer. Do you want him to like it? No.
No, that's a great quote. I haven't heard that. No, I think some of the students have been more open to it. What I've been doing is just, I can't help myself if someone says something in the group message. It's so hard for me to not just say something if it's just blatantly statist. And I just, hey, maybe you don't need to be this much of a bootlicker, but it's really ingrained into a lot of these people some of them are here for money, right? And they don't really care about anything.
Yeah.
Some are very into criminal justice reform, and a lot of those people are definitely more into the ideas of, hey, government's awful. Look for alternatives, but those people just don't want to hear it.
Yeah, you can tell the difference between like the people who are here just for like prestige and want to get a job that makes a lot of money, and then you can tell the people who are like ideologues, which I would consider myself, like, whether or not you're left or right, I'm definitely that. I'm going to be doing public interest work. Like, I'm willing to take a fucking pay cut to not sell my soul to the devil.
Tall building attorneys, or right after law school, or when you're just doing 80 hours of filling out forms.
That's my nightmare.
And eventually, we got to bring my dad out so he can talk about Shelley. He's been dormant in the closet, just working away. But big moves in Texas.
And you still doing that, Kay?
Secession stuff. Oh yeah, that's gonna go on for a while.
What are we? What is this? What's going on?
Shelley Luther won, the salon owner. I've been out in law school, so I don't know where it's at right now. But it was whenever basically the beginning of COVID restrictions. There was a Dallas salon owner, Shelley Luther, and she essentially just didn't want to shut down, and they arrested her for contempt of court, and we got her out, and now she's running for a position, I think, in Texas. I don't remember what position. She's been campaigning a lot on Facebook, and I just kind of scroll past it because I don't want to think about that. Creating another politician, that's not a thing. But you got to get more to talk about that, and that's not something. But,
yeah. I was just saying, you're from Texas originally?
Yes, sir. Born and raised.
Nice.
Very mysterious state. But it's actually really good. It's very beautiful. Everyone's really nice. It's like a jungle here, actually. Very humid, which as a Texan, that hurts a lot.
Yeah.
But people talk about, Southern hospitality. In Texas, we have Southern hospitality, but we mean business. We have work to do. We'll be polite, but we don't want to scuffle about all day. But here people are so, like, that is real. There's real Southern comfort here.
And yeah.
I was trying to sign the lease of this apartment, and I was like, hey, you're saying you're doing renovations. Can you just put that into my lease? And then it's like they almost got offended. I was like, oh, how dare you? You can't take my word? We are just friends here. He's like, this is why I hate lawyers. But people are really nice here, so I love this place.
Yeah. I spent a night in Birmingham back in June because I went to the Mises Institute for the graduate seminar. But the day before, there was a Mises meetup at Allendale Brewing.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Yes. Yeah, so I flew into Birmingham and then got an Airbnb at this place, and I was finishing up like the last pages of Human Action, reading it, and I was sitting out on the porch with my Airbnb hosts, and they were like winding it up on the porch. You know, they're drinking. I went down to the store, got a couple beers, and then I sit down on their porch, on the other end of the porch from them, and I start reading Human Action. And the one host, the woman, looks at me and she goes, "Hey, I recognize that book. Is that Mises?" And I'm just like, "Yeah, it is." And they were like Mises supporters. And the dude, the husband, my host, he was planning on going to the same Mises event that I was there to go to. So he, the next day, drove me to the brewery and we went to the event together. So it was like, that's like your ideal Airbnb experience.
Small world.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, and to really make it funny, I met this other guy who was doing the same thing. He was going to the seminar, but he wanted to go to this Mises meetup. So he got an Airbnb in Birmingham too, but his was the opposite experience. So mine was kind of like on the street going up into the mountain, right? So it's like this really steep street with all these houses on it. And then this guy, I don't know exactly remember where it was, but he got an Airbnb, you know, some bad neighborhood, like ghetto or whatever. He didn't know where he was going. Like, there was no address on the building. There was like this creepy old guy out front who was the host, but he wouldn't like talk to him when he first showed up because he was acting really suspicious. And then when he goes inside of the room, there's a wall missing. And it's just like a tarp, you know, for one of the walls. And he said that in the middle of the night, some cat just jumped on his bed. He didn't even know there was like a cat around. It just came in through like a window and jumped on his bed. He said he left the place at like 6 a.m. as soon as he could.
The fence is coming ahead of time.
Yeah.
They give him a bad setup.
Yeah, for sure.
Were there any cool speakers at Avondale, I guess?
Yeah, there was... Well, Jeff Dice spoke, and he always is great. And they also had Patrick Newman. They were originally planning on doing, I think it was Mark Thornton was originally going to do it. But he was pretty, I think he was pretty skittish about the COVID stuff.
Yeah, because I remember hearing about that at Mises.
Right, he was one of the...
Because I think his husband is...
Immunocompromised.
Compromised or whatever.
Yeah. But, Patrick Newman gave a good speech. I think they were basically just talking about the effect that the lockdowns and COVID and the printing, you know, Fed's printing of money is going to have on the economy and everything that's going to be going on. But then it was really cool because after the event, Patrick Newman drove me to Auburn, which was pretty chill to be able to ride in the car with him. So that was fun.
Wow. Just strike up a casual conversation. Just, hey there.
Yeah.
You like Alabama?
Yeah. I ate lunch with him a few times during Mises U. He's really cool. We were talking about like Borat and shit. He's younger, so you know, he's a little bit easier to like, you know, relate to than some of the old guard at the institute.
Definitely.
The Mises U, because I feel raw because I haven't been able to go. And then there was the Ron Paul Symposium, which I also missed out on.
It was amazing. It was probably one of the best weeks of my life. The symposium, Stratty, how was it? I watched it online. It was awesome.
Oh, man. I think it was honestly, Solomon, a lot better than last year's one, man. It was because of what's been going on. It made it a lot more, you know, significant, kind of. But Ron Paul's brother was there, Wayne Paul. And I had a good conversation with him, and God, just the look in this dude's eyes, man, his body's not there, but mentally, you can tell all these dudes are there. Like, even at Mises U, Dave even noticed that with, like, Lou Rockwell. He was like, Lou's body's not there, but in his eyes, you can see he just wants to keep going.
The fire, absolutely.
Yeah.
That was really cool to see.
Well, maybe I can make
it. But there... Yeah, I mean, I hope there is a next year, you know. I just get
very
scared sometimes.
Very true. Yeah. No, we're not manifesting anything, so.
Yes.
No, awesome. No. I think Ron Paul's going to live to be 100, so.
Yeah.
That guy's a machine. He's truly incredible.
Yeah, definitely.
It's energy. the fact that he just keeps going right after.
Weekday, he does the Liberty Report, and he's always done some kind of report like that. Even in the 80s and 90s, he had a little newsletter he sent out. But I have so much admiration for that dude. Was he how you got into all this, Solomon?
I would really say, I guess you could say he's the butt for a cause.
Yes.
I would really say my dad was probably the biggest influence. You know, I've just always been learning under him, and he grew up very black and white libertarian. He was getting signatures for Ron Paul whenever he was running, and really into that. And I remember when I was a kid, I just remember seeing him at some convention because I used to be a page every once in a while and for Republicans. And that's the difference between my dad is my dad's definitely more Trump supporter, goes more into working within the state, minarchist vibes. So we branch off there. But he's, he grew up loving Ron Paul and really into that stuff. And then I read, some Hayek and went down the road of economics and yes. Eventually Rothbard. And but at first I had a Keynesian phase, I remember in college, I was just starting and everything we were learning was very Keynesian. And there's some good Keynesian stuff, it's not terrible. It's interesting models to think about. But it was just all hogwash, really. And then I had to read Hayek on my own. You ever watched the rap battle of Hayek and
Mises? I mean, Marx.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a Mises Marx one. There's the F.A. Hayek and Keynes one. They've got a couple. I remember seeing that in my first micro. I was like, who is Hayek?
Yeah.
And it's just right there. But I think the first book I read, though, that really brought me into this was Frederick Bastiat's The Law.
Yeah, that's such a great book. I love how it's like it blends economics and law. You know what I mean? Like so much, especially in my experience in law school, so many people have no economic knowledge whatsoever. And, I think it's essential, honestly. I really think that it has to be thought of and understood because, there's just so many important insights about, what our knowledge of human action can be and, our knowledge and our understanding of human action has to inform law because law is about humans acting, in concert with each other. So, I think the insights of economic are indispensable to actually coming up with good laws.
I just remember, what were we taught in high school about economics? Did y'all have an economics class?
I never took an economics class. No, I took AP Gov. There was a civics and econ that other people would take, but the smart kids would take AP Gov, and that had absolutely nothing to do with economics.
Our coach was, of course, our economics teacher, and it was very basic, supply curves and the very basics. And whenever you have the high school teacher coaches teaching Keynesian economics, and that's probably prevalent throughout the majority of your society, you're asking for a bad time.
Yeah.
Or first off, so no one wants to go into it, and it's wrong. It's just not good.
With my high school economics class, it was very Keynesian, but it never addressed itself as Keynesian. And I remember sitting there and learning all the models and being like, when the fuck am I ever going to use these specific models? I understand where the basic knowledge of economics will come into play because it's how it plays out in our life. But when am I ever going to chart out a model and look at it? And I don't. It just felt a lot so useless, and none of the questions I actually had were answered. I'm thankful I had that class because it kind of hammered into my head the basics, but other than that, it sucked. And the same goes for my college economics. It's not different. It doesn't address itself as Keynesian either, which really bothered me.
Yeah, dude, I took a econ in college, and I took econ after getting into Austrian economics. So I had never taken an econ class until my junior year of college. Yeah. And then but I had already been studying the Austrians from the time I was a sophomore. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to take these econ classes just to learn the other side and to get the credits and, you know, broaden my understanding of all this stuff. And I mean, holy crap. I remember almost nothing. I remember almost nothing from my economic classes in college, especially intermediate micro. I remember nothing. Just reading Human Action alone, I learned so much more in a matter of a month just by myself than I did with a whole semester of instruction by one of these fools.
Yeah, most economics programs, at least what I've been told, don't have history of economic thought where you go through all the great economists and, well, great, you know, it, which is according to the professor, you know, whatever he wants to teach, you know. You know, we had one in our college, and we went, or I think he mentioned Hayek. We had like one thing on Hayek, but you know, nothing on Mises. You know, very Keynesian. You know, we looked at other cultures and other, you know, famous economists in other parts of the world, but Austrians were maybe 1% of the conversation. And it's just sad. It's just not what is taught ever. But
yeah. It is a shame, but, you know, that's why we're in the fight. You got to spread the message. So, Solomon, I want to ask you and get your answer to this, because I'm dying to know.
Okay.
Why did you decide to go to law school? Why did you do this to yourself? Why did you make this mistake that I also have made and I'm now living with?
I woke up one morning and I was like, I want $100,000 to make my life harder, just to make it easier for the enemy. You know,
yeah.
I think it's playing field, you know, make it even on all sides. I don't know. I've been grappling with law school for many, many years. You know, my dad's been in life crisis with law school. He was an engineer before then. He opened up a firm right out, and I kind of started working for him. High school, just, and I wrote some complaints later on and doing some IP work, but I've always been very against it. I remember being very rebellious and being kind of wishy-washy with my parents, because they're like, okay, are you gonna do this or not? And I just screwed around for a little bit, but ultimately I've decided it's a good time, because pandemic, you know, business is low, you know, dystopian, you know, why not just get some grant money and study the law and think about things and prepare for what's coming. But also, if I went to hell, I feel like you have to know them to beat them.
Yeah.
I don't think also a lot of the liberty movement right now is very informational, and they're working, you know, people are working in think tanks, and I think that's very important to people. Some people work inside politics, and I think that's very important. Some people work completely outside, just doing, you know, like podcasts and informational stuff. But I think we need more fighters in the judicial system, because there are very few lawyers that do law specifically for keeping governments in check. And that's part of the job of the attorney. You know, you have to. You have a monopolized court system that interprets laws and public policy rationales. You now have all central planning according to whatever those public policy rationales are, have been decided by whatever judge or jury is in charge. And I just think if we're going to actually do this fight, we have to have soldiers everywhere. So I think my opportunity costs are best served here. I don't know. I still every day I kind of wake up like, why am I here?
It's tough. I'll tell you what. When I first started, and I was in my first semester, I really didn't know exactly what I wanted to do with it. I didn't go into law school with a solid plan, because I didn't even really know what like public interest litigation was at the time. I just kind of went through college and got this philosophy degree or whatever. You know, I got a general studies degree, but it was philosophy and history and a few other things.
And I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah. So I didn't have a concentrated degree. I just studied a lot of different stuff. and got a very holistic view. And I thought, well, okay, this degree is basically worthless for a job. So I should find something a little bit more practical to do. And law made sense because it uses all of the things that I had already learned. So that's why I decided to go to law school, just because it seemed like a natural next step to everything I've been learning and a practical next step. And then as I went through it more, I learned what public interest litigation was, and I was like, this is it. This is how I get to fight for liberty, you know, and you know, stand by my principles. But I remember the first few semesters, probably first year, year and a half of law school. Like I understood what I was learning day to day, but like integration of everything really didn't take hold until like halfway through or later. Have you kind of had that similar kind of feeling where sometimes you feel like the ideas don't like connect because there's just so much that you're trying to grapple with?
It's a lot of input, right? Yeah. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of information, and you're learning how the system does it, but you're also fighting it in your brain because you're trying to look, okay, like, well, what are the alternatives to right. some bad laws, or what's the alternative to the monopoly? You know, I mean, when it comes to specific types of law, I mean, lawyers will always be around, I think, you know, even without a government or without a state, you know, in a free, you know, in Kapistan, I'm sure we'll still have lawyers need to, you know, work through parties' issues.
Without a doubt, without a doubt. Especially if business becomes more complex and more, you know, you have more deals, you need more contract attorneys, you know?
It's just, you know, we have this monopolized system, and I would say it's pretty janky, but it could be a lot worse. So it's not horrible.
Yeah, it could be a lot worse.
That's the thing, though.
So,
it can real fast if we don't do something.
Exactly.
So I have a question for both y'all, because I'm sure you've had to deal with your law school peers that hung on economics. And I want to ask y'all each, do you notice is there a view on the law in a way that you would say is kind of wrong? And then do you think that's due to their views on economics?
You go first.
Well, yeah, if I understand your question, I mean, I think definitely. I mean, I've noticed from some of my peers, especially, you know, probably the younger ones, the ones who are about my age, because I went right into law school after I graduated college. I took no break. So people about my age, they say things in class about like what the government should do or you know, this or that, and it seems like they have no understanding of opportunity cost. They have no understanding of, you know, how wealth is created and production works. They seem to have this kind of, you know, pie in the sky, like they don't stop to think what are going to be the unseen consequences to anything we do. They just kind of look at what's in front of them. And I think that's a thing that lawyers have a problem with, because especially common law lawyers, and I think it's not necessarily a bad thing, because when you're trying to do justice, you need to understand the facts of the case in front of you. But I think sometimes they focus too much on that, and they lose like the seen and the unseen. Bastiat, right? They're always looking at what's in front of them and what actually happened, and they're not thinking about, okay, well, what, you know, what's the economic rationale of this or that policy. So I don't know. I don't think the law is meant necessarily to do that, or like, you know, I think the law is meant to do justice, not meant to tweak economic incentives in a sense, because you got to base it on property and damage. So I don't know. It's a complex issue, but I think that ultimately I think lawyers focus sometimes too much on that, and they don't think about the consequences of a given policy.
Yeah, for me, I've certainly had the conversation of who will build the roads a lot this semester. Most of these people, you know, there's a fella in my awareness guy in my class, and he used to work for some of the companies that actually did build the actual roads. You know, we've had this conversation during group meeting with the whole class, and you know, I mean, he's right. You know, he's not the government, and he's building roads. But I'd explain to them the okay, well, in libertarian discussion, you know, this is the common phrase, and I was simply joking and you know, explaining it all, but. I think most of these people have a lot of experience of the world. You know, they've very, you know, a lot of these people worked in DA's offices, in these businesses, but I don't think they've just thought of the alternatives. You know, they haven't thought of, okay, well, if we didn't have government, literally, how would we do this? And whenever we, or someone like me, or say like, hey, apply that to everything, even the court system, even the military, it's just, that's just like what are you speaking a different language? Why are you talking about this? We have the law. This is good. We need this. This is how, you know everyone. We also may have different views on how a free society ought to work, but I think a lot of these people are open to these ideas, especially when you see this absolute shenanigans of the two-party system right now. It's really helping us out. And I think that's opening them up more to the ideas that, hey, we don't need these people. We could just work it out voluntarily. But it's just hard for them to, you know, like, how do we punish criminals? How do we punish the bad actors? That's what it all comes down to a lot in these conversations. And then there are some who are very left-leaning here who, you know, don't believe in property, right?
Yeah.
And that's a whole different other issue. Yeah. Privatizing the oceans is not something that a environmental studies law person wants to really hear. But my friend, who's she and I have been talking about this for after the semester, and you know, running out of sand and you know, building fences in the ocean if is the result of privatization. And I don't know. I think it's hopeful because I think we're opening up more to these ideas. We got a long way to go. And professors don't help either.
No, definitely not. I remember I had one professor. We read a case in con law. Some county of Winnebago versus some person, and this person sued the county and sued like the child services or some comparable agency because this kid was in an abusive home and. We're looking into it, and they, at one point, I think they might have taken the kid away and brought him back or something, and then the kid ended up, you know, getting beaten by his father, and then died, and then, you know, somebody sued the agency for, you know, negligence or, you know, not taking care or, like, equal protection violation, you know, something along those lines, and I think it was Rehnquist who wrote the opinion, and he was, the Constitution only applies against the government, so the government constitutionally can't violate your rights, but the Constitution doesn't create a positive duty on the government to keep your rights from being violated or something along those lines. The government would be liable if, like, the child service worker, you know, beat the child, but the parent beating the child, that wasn't a cause of liability for the government. And the professor basically takes this and then she goes, why don't we basically just have, the entire welfare state and all this money given to children and the government funds children's food and education and everything. And it's just like, there's a pretty big chasm there. Like I don't think you've thought this through. Like, yeah, the decision is troubling, at least in the gut, but they take emotional cases like that and then they try to extend them beyond what they can reasonably do.
What's that Thomas Sowell quote? It's not judging programs by not judging programs by their results but by their intentions. I'm opposite. But everyone here, it's all about, oh, we have good intentions and we're using government. So therefore the good intentions make it okay. It doesn't matter the medium. Screw the results of what actually happens. That does matter. And when you, especially with bringing up the welfare state, it's, there's a lot of people in law school who want to help poor people, want to do that reform. That's great. They all are for nanny state government. And you're just like, please know, we were able to take care of people before government. Welfare state's pretty new, and it's not necessarily helped anybody.
It's just a weird logical assumption they make that we need these services, and therefore we need the state, because they assume that the state's the only one who can provide these resources. But it's like, these resources and services, but it's just kind of, like you said before, they haven't considered any alternative, and they don't think about the kind of like what I said before, the unseen consequences. It's like, just because you have a state and it provides some certain services, that doesn't by necessity mean that something else couldn't do it better, because that's a counterfactual. We don't know. Chalking up, like looking at the data and looking at what's actually existed, that's important practically from how to move from point A to point B. But in terms of like theory and what can work, that's a separate issue. And just because something hasn't existed or hasn't been tried or you haven't seen it before doesn't mean it's not viable. It's kind of a blue-pilled mindset.
You have to have some imagination for this type of stuff. And I think a lot of people have been indoctrinated, of course, through school system, just propaganda, which some propaganda is on purpose, right? And others is just patriotism. Everything to be a patriot is to be obedient. That's what America's. That's our whole deal. I think it's part of innovation. When you see, name me some libertarian country that's existed. I hate that question, because while it's a valid question, sometimes you can give a good answer. It's not looking to the imaginative possibilities. This week we saw a rocket do a flip, right? That was incredible. Could I have 50 years ago said, oh, that would never exist? You're never gonna be able to do that. Whenever people say, how are you going to be able to get from a government society that we have now to a free society, it reminds me of people like who told the colonists that, hey, you're not going to survive without the crown. Now, sadly, the results of that were a crazy big government, but it's fine.
Well, every single specific point in history is unique. There is no two points in history that are exactly the same. So just that fact alone disproves the entire idea that, you can't consider something that hasn't been tried just because it hasn't been tried. Every moment in history is us moving forward and doing things we haven't done before and living in circumstances that are different. So, lack of imagination. I think that's a good way of putting it.
Well, one thought I had while listening to what y'all were saying, and Dave, you brought up data. What's funny is, I know, none of us here are empiricists per se, but empiricism has its upside. Here's the funny thing, though. All on empiricists, the true data, the raw data, is not on their side. It's on our side when it comes to what happens with these government programs and what they do. So what did they do with the data? They put it in such a way where it makes government look good. They do it in the media all the time. They do it in our textbooks. They do it in everything. And that's the only way they can make themselves look good, is by misconstruing what is being said. Funny to me that they do it with their own method, which is empiricism. Like, the data is not on their side, but they find a way to make it on their side.
It is so easy to manipulate statistics. It is scarily easy to manipulate statistics.
Have y'all watched Tom Sewell's appearance on Firing Line before?
Yeah, with the woman and the glasses. Oh my god, I can't believe there's not more memes of her. Why are there not more memes of that woman?
I don't know. We should make some after this, though.
Yes,
it's our duties. We've assumed it.
Anyway, go on, Salman.
That episode. One of my favorite things about Sewell is that Yeah, he's. I'm not sure if I would classify him as someone who likes empiricism, but he's very versed in it, right? And that whole episode, he's just going through all the data on race and the discussion that he had with that woman, and just destroying all the things that they bring up. And I think that is beautiful. He's like number one pick when it comes to like using that type of discussion. It's disprove their own ideas that they're pushing.
Yeah, well, in terms of the race issue, I mean, the biggest, especially in America, the biggest empirical piece of data for me was how before, post Civil War, but pre Johnson Great Society, Blacks' upward mobility was better. You know, their illegitimacy rate in birth was much lower. You know, the family was more intact. They were more stable. There was less crime, less drug abuse. And like I said, upward class mobility and getting into economic positions and making money. That was all on the up and up. And then once the 60s hit, it stopped. So it's like, that's a pretty big piece of data that they just kind of overlook. I mean, I remember I took a class in college and they were like showing data on this. But none of the graphs they were showing went before like 1950. Mm. This isn't the only thing you can show. Like, you have to show what was going on before then in order to get it. So it's, yeah, you can really easily manipulate that stuff.
We have the manipulation aspect. And then when we see things like what's happening right now with COVID.
Yeah.
Manipulation. Are people don't even question the premises or question anything.
There's one thing, manipulating data is one thing, but also the question is, do you trust the people who made the data in the first place?
Hell
no. Or reported it? Those are two separate issues, because you can have a completely reputable data, but someone picks and chooses out of it. But, you know, if you know, like with these COVID things, like, you know, some guy shoots himself in the head and dies in Michigan, and then gets counted as a COVID death because he tested positive.
Not real?
I'm pretty sure that's real.
Well, I know there was a kid in like Florida who a drug deal went bad, and he got shot like 9 times, and he was listed as a COVID death.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Did you? I saw a video. My mother sent it to me. So I come from a conservative background. You said you kind of came from a more libertarian with your father, but my family was always pretty conservative, the libertarian streak, but but pretty conservative. And my mother has been getting very much more progressively red-pilled over the past year. And it's really beautiful to see. And I don't expect she'll ever, you know, fully come around. But you know, to at least see that coming out of her is great. And she sent me this video today of some attorney, for the Department of Justice, or some guy who works for the Department of Justice, who was doing a press conference, and you could see behind the person took it with their phone or something, and you could see behind where he was standing before he walks out. And he's just standing there with no mask on. He's doing his thing, you know, whatever. And then, all right, oh, time to go on. He puts on the mask. He walks out. And then he takes it right off before he stops talking. Yes. And it's just like, you know what? It's time to say no.
Someone put clown music or like circus music to that. And I posted it on my story yesterday. It was hilarious.
Oh, my God. Dun, 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 dun. Yeah.
So whenever... whenever me and Dave were in Alabama from Mises, they had the mask mandate brought in while during the week we were at Mises, but no one really followed it. So I got to ask, is it getting followed now?
Oh, people are like, Alabama, people do not really care. I think people will still wear masks, but I see people in gas stations, Walmart stores all the time, no masks. And, you know, whenever out on Friday, not a lot of masks in the bars or social distancing. And I mean, I personally have, we've had some people get sick in classes, but I haven't seen anybody here. It's already, my friends got COVID and we've been out a ton. Now I might have antibodies, who knows, but no one cares.
Yeah. It's the way it should be.
Now, because they'll require masks, and then, you know, right when you get in, it's like the first 30 seconds, you know, okay, is this guy cool with me not having a mask on, or what's his
name?
Yeah.
It's funny. But.
Exactly. Yeah. The thing that really gets me is when you see people walking alone on the street or in a car wearing their mask.
Oh, God, and they have a fucking mask on.
Like, I'm getting viscerally, like, I don't know if I'd call it anger, but it's like, it's getting near when I see somebody wearing a mask when they're alone. Bro, like, you're better than this.
Dude, you just reminded me. So, this summer, there's this family across the street, and there's a little girl, and she always plays with her friends. Dude, one of the friends that comes over all the time, she always wears a mask when she's playing with her friends. And it's so fucking weird. It just depresses me.
Yeah, my mother teaches piano lessons. That's her job. She teaches piano.
Oh, God. And a kid wore a mask?
And I walked into the room because I had, like, my backpack was in her piano room. Because I use her piano room to study sometimes because sometimes it's the only room in the house I can get some privacy. And I left my backpack in there, and I went in there to get it when she was giving a kid a piano lesson, and he's sitting there with a mask on, and I'm just like, you know, this kid's probably 6 years old. Ugh. I mean, if I was 6 years old, I believed everything I was told. So if I'm told that everyone's dying and the world's ending, I already have anxiety. Like, I can't imagine how bad my anxiety would be if I was a kid who grew up through this. And also, Dave Smith made an interesting point on one of his recent podcasts. He said that, think about the babies who are being born.
Yeah.
And the first, I mean, those first few months of your life are so important. And these babies are seeing nothing but masked faces. We have no idea what the effects in 10, 15, 20, 30 years of these people growing up, what kind of psychological effect it's going to have when they were born and they didn't see a human face until they were 8 months old or whatever. That's a scary thought.
Oh, I don't like
What sickened me was, so they just had the Pfizer vaccine given out to people in the UK, and it's coming to the US. Well, four people who got it in the UK have Bell's palsy now, developed from after having this vaccine. There were literally people defending that and saying, well, if we're wearing a mask, it doesn't really matter, right? What the hell? What kind of thinking? There's no fucking human feeling there. There's no humanity there. There's no realization of what... You know how... Like, I didn't realize it until all this stuff started happening. But you know how great it is just to see someone... Some total stranger in a store, on the street. You know how great it is to see a beautiful smile on someone? And another thing is their parents are fucking crazy and they make their kid wear a mask. And that's causing brain damage. These babies are having brain damage, and people are now, if you bring it up to anyone, they'd say, oh, well, we got to protect against this virus. So we're sacrificing our future. Literally, these kids are not going to grow up healthy, and they're not going to grow up able to recognize human emotions through the face.
The government is really good at selling the future out. That's what they specialize in. You know, they'll do it. I mean, why are we surprised? They'll do it in terms of saddling future generations with debt and inflating currencies. Why wouldn't they do it with a simple mask mandate? It's you know, that's the thing for me. These people who think like the government has provably done so many horrible things. Why do they trust it still?
Yeah. Well, like the Tuskegee syphilis experience.
Syphilis, yeah.
Yes, please talk about that.
I mean, it's just like I was reading something about it this morning, and we learned about it in high school, but it's a quick little 2 minutes. This happened, bam. They don't talk about how screwed up it was, what happened. They don't talk about the details, but like, for 40 years, the U.S. government had this experiment going on where they're giving black men syphilis. And seeing what the hell's going to happen. And the government did this. The CDC had, the FDA, they all had hands in this. We're taught this in high school, like even for 2 minutes, though, and no one thinks about it after that. No one questions it. No one thinks like, hey, I wonder what other fucked up things they've done. And look what the CDC and FDA is doing now. It's those two agencies especially get away with so much.
Stratty, that was in the backwards past in the history books. We're enlightened now.
Yeah, you're right, Dave. I need to quit being so...
Yeah.
The fact that, like, I got into a Facebook argument the other day with a classmate and his friend regarding some of this stuff. And the fact that, and I mentioned the Tuskegee experiment, and okay, now that I've seen that the government is capable of these horrible things, you know, the potential for that has, you know, it's been satisfied. This thing can happen underneath this institution. I'm going to continue supporting it, of course, because, you know, at least if it was free market, you know, it'd probably go away because we're not giving money to this, but, you know, it's coercive. We don't have a choice. And we're also all of Stockholm syndrome here, which is great. And we can't live without it. But the fact that you know that this thing is a possibility and you still cannot even question the premises. Or like the fact, okay, I see the situation. Yeah, no, I'm not going to question this at all. I'm just going to listen to everything. Like, it's you know, foolproof. These people have never lied. You know, there's tons of videos of them breaking their own laws, their own orders. You know, there's just, what could go wrong? No, I'm going to get this vaccine and I'm going to be obedient because it's patriotic to do so. It blows my mind. Makes me want to die. And I linked, or I was telling him, or it was this person said, mandates don't require violence. And they were saying that the fact that we'll ban you from travel if you don't get the vaccine or whatever, you know, that's not violence. You know, we're not used, no one's using a gun there. Just absolutely ridiculous. And yeah, it's just blows my mind.
It's a sad state, but it is what it is. This is the fight of our lives. It's like a movie, dude. I feel like I'm in a movie.
Me and Dave just recorded an episode talking about how crazy the 2020 has been in store for us. And it's like our 1960s, in a sense.
I want zombies. I feel like we deserve zombies.
You want zombies? Yeah. We deserve zombies.
We just need a zombie apocalypse. It'll be at least fun. You know, we can survive. It'll be like a little game, and we'll all die. It'll be great. Yeah.
See, I kind of want FEMA camps everywhere. I want the UN to start marching in and setting things up, making sure everything's running good. What about you, Dave? What's your ideal apocalypse?
My ideal apocalypse. Jeez. I think zombies sounds pretty good. I could put my vote in for zombies.
I'm the only one that's going for globalists here.
Globalists. It's a hard second. Easy second.
Can they be globalist zombies? I mean, they practically are zombies the way they behave and
oh my gosh.
Speak and...
do you have a upper level writing requirement at your law school? Do you have to do a paper before you graduate?
That's an excellent question, and I feel like I should definitely know that, but I don't.
Most law schools have to write at least one scholarly paper before you leave.
We had legal writing this year, or this semester, if that counts. We're going to do an appeal next semester.
Yeah.
Baby L1s over here.
Yep. Yes. So what was your favorite class from first semester?
Yeah, that's a good question. Contracts, I think, came pretty easy to me. I've kind of worked in a little bit of contracts at home, but torts was interesting because we had a lot of our professors. Really loved hypotheticals and really loved sexual hypotheticals.
Oh,
so
geez.
That made for, you know, a great time. Her essay for our final was like a 5-page fact pattern of just whips, chains, the handcuffs. It was great. At least, yeah, there's some batteries in there. And criminal law is interesting because you have the state as a party. And, you know, we had a lot of criminal justice discussions in class, and I really appreciate our professor for doing that. Civil procedure, though, I think was one of the more interesting ones. I say it was dry because on the day-to-day because it's just you're learning rules. But I think the implied consent idea for personal jurisdiction for a court to have on you, that idea for me has just been wrestling with that for like years. And it goes back to the discussion of the differences between an HOA and a government, right? How does how does a court assert, or how does an institution assert its laws over you? You know, and you have discussions of purposeful availment, and we can go into the nitty gritty law and bore every listener that's around. But
bro, this is what we're here for. So I must ask you, please do get into the nitty gritty here, because I haven't studied Civ Pro since I was first year, so I need to be reminded. So please indulge me.
Well, it's the larger conversation is, you know, we have government and the Constitution. It's we have implied consent by the people, hence they have power. And say governance in itself is not inherently bad, but when it's monopolized coercive governments that's against your will, then that's where the problem's starting, right?
I agree.
So I can voluntarily prescribe to institutions, and I can voluntarily prescribe to governments and leaders. You know, the whole mantra is if you need a leader, you're not fit to choose one. I was never a fan of that. You could voluntarily choose leaders. I don't understand that. But for the U.S. justice system decides that it has jurisdiction over you, and to be hailed into court, you know, to be subject to his laws with implied consent. And there's a bunch of cases that, you know, for many years, it was really just awful. You know, international shoot, does that ring a bell anywhere?
Oh, yeah. That rings a bell.
That'll ring a big bell. You know, all that stuff. You know, when if I go into a land of another party and I purposely avail, like I am exercising conduct that gives me the benefits of the protections of the laws of that land, does that mean that land can now put me in prison if I disobey some arbitrarily decided law? You know, these types of, that's where it gets really difficult for me when it comes to, when my friends are asking me, you know, what's the difference between an HOA imposing its rules on you? And you know, if I was born into an HOA, does that mean the HOA has implied consent over me the same way a government does? You know, I have a hard time answering some of these questions. I don't know. But that stuff has been really prevalent in civil procedure. And some of my more lib left friends at home, they always get me on that one, because you know, I would say, you know, okay, can I consent to the HOA's laws at 18? Am I making any sense here?
No, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, like, I just don't know. What do you think? Do you think that, what's the difference between an HOA and a government? Let's start there. That's the always the big question.
Well, in HOA, you can voluntarily join a government. I mean, you can voluntarily join a government, but you can't necessarily leave every government you can join. Whereas you can leave any HOA you're a part of.
And also, I think there's a crucial difference in the, like, the decision making process in terms of like the power to tax, other kind of things like that. I think that there's other kind of powers that the government asserts that an HOA doesn't, that kind of change the nature of the analysis. Because, like, even if you join a government, right, you know, say you move from one state to another in the union, say we're born in, you know, born in Texas and moved to Alabama, right? So are you, you know, are you consenting to the laws of Alabama? Well, maybe you could say you were consenting to the laws of Alabama at point A, but then the legislature is going to pass new laws, new court decisions are going to be made. And in my opinion, with the kind of real politic view that I take of politics and legislation, you know, I don't think that's consensual. I don't think you're, even if you vote, I don't think that amounts to real actual consent and real actual self-government. Whereas with a homeowners association, you're making a direct contract that says, you know, I will abide by this, but if you change something I don't like, I can leave, right? And, you know, there's some of that with the federal system. But I mean, ultimately, you can't get away from the federal government unless you move to another state that does the same kind of thing where it taxes you and takes out debt in your name. And, you know, I think there's other kind of powers that a state has that are not synonymous. But it is a tough question. It definitely is. It reminds me, I mean, I'm not totally against the idea of implied consent in itself.
Yeah.
That's like kind of Kinsella's estoppel theory, where he's like, if you batter somebody and you use violence against them, then you can't then say that their court can't assert violence against you in order to make you pay damages because you used violence. So then you can't say that they can't use violence. You would be a stop. There's a contradiction. So I think, you know, effectively you impliedly consent to the jurisdiction of another person when you attack them or do violence against them. So I don't think that the idea is totally wrong. And I think that's something that certain libertarians miss. But I think that there's a big chasm between a homeowners association and a state in terms of the powers it asserts. I think that's the key difference.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that, you know, if I am purposely availing myself to a community, you know, and I am doing business in that community, I think it's perfectly reasonable for me to be subject to whatever justice system that community has. If I voluntarily, you know, choose to go interact with those communities, it's just hard for whenever I see this giant colossus government that we have, and it's written into. Because my implied consent stops somewhere, right? I haven't consented to all this crap. You know, but it always, for many of the general political people, it's the vote. You know, you consented to have this person make decisions for you.
Right. They treat a vote like a contract.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's misplaced. They also talk about, like, they make those kind of arguments where, like, well, you drove on the road.
Yes. That.
You know, you called the cops when someone was attacking you, you know, but also that's the same argument as, well, you know, I got thrown in a concentration camp and I ate the food, you know, like, you know, it's not just because you accept something or you use something doesn't mean that you consent to the system at large. You know, you're just saying, okay, like, I will actually die if I don't eat this food, or I will actually die if I don't call this cop, or, you know, I will actually die if I can't drive down the road to get to my job and make money. You know, if a mugger has a gun to your ribs and you give him your money, well, you consented. That's the problem right there, that we need to figure out the nature of violence in order to understand where, like you said, where does that consent end? Because I think, like you said, it is absolutely reasonable to say that by going to a restaurant, you consent to the rules of the restaurant. And if you don't like it, you leave. But, you know, that's private property. That's not public property.
Well, it's the social contract, right? We're doing this all for the name of society. You know, we don't care that our society is blowing up our kids in the Middle East. We can overlook that as long as, safe from this vaccine or safe from this disease that's going to kill everybody. It's just ridiculous. Are you doing Zoom classes or so? How's
it
working?
We got the Zoom.
Oh God, I didn't know you were doing Zoom classes.
Yeah.
What about you, Solomon?
It's like half and half. Half Zoom classes, a couple in person with, you know, social distance, stickered, you know, masks on. Some of the professors wear masks in their house on Zoom. I'm not sure why, but it's fine.
Yeah, it's a damn shame. I really did feel like I lost a lot of the in class kind of, like, it's harder to focus. It really is.
Yeah, I'm watching Legally Blonde, and I want professors to walk up to me and make a fool out of me. Yeah, I want the law school experience.
Yeah.
It's just when I can't see their face, and it's just, I feel robbed. But you want to be a litigator?
Yeah, that's probably the goal. I mean, I don't know if I want to be in court, like actually making the arguments and stuff, but I definitely want to do the public interest, you know, be part of a team, either do research behind the scenes, memos, whatever. But yeah, that's definitely what I want to do, at least until I get the loan forgiveness. And then from then on, we'll see what happens.
Sheesh. I'm jealous. Maybe I should go do that just for that.
You have to take a pay cut, but if you, and it's a big commitment because you have to do it for 10 years. You have to make, and you have to make every payment for 120 months. So as long as you're at a qualifying place, employer, and you make every payment for 120 months and, you know, you keep up on all the, you cross the T's and dot the I's, you can get whatever's left just forgiven after 10 years, which is a pretty good deal. I'm fine with it.
I'm going to be paying this for forever until I die, unless inflation kicks in. But I think it might not be if it's expected. I have to look at all that. But
well, they might just waive it all. Yeah. They might just say, no, you don't have to pay it anymore.
Biden might, but I don't know if they'll do that. Maybe not for grad students, though. They're gonna pay grad students for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. Well, Solomon, I think we're going to wrap it up. Do you want to give your plugs? Where can people find you?
Yeah, you can follow me on Instagram at Solomon Norred, SOLOMONNORRED. You can also find norredlaw.com. We got some just plugging in the family biz. And you can't really find me and Twitter, which is also Solomon Norred. So
I will say it's so nice to see a fellow libertarian law student so out in the open about about their
business. Yeah, no, Solomon's one of the most open people in this I know of, and I love it.
Yeah, it's really, really nice to see that because, I mean, I do kind of, I don't really speak up in class, and I kind of have walked on eggshells for years just trying to not cause a fight. But it's really nice. It makes me feel really good to see that and to know that there are other people doing what I'm going to be doing who believe the same stuff and can be open about it and aren't going to be afraid about whatever people are going to say. So it's inspiring, dude. Thanks, man.
We're all a team, and I appreciate you guys having me on. And
of course, man.
Let's do this again.
Yeah, this has been fun. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll catch you next time.